Hey, everybody. Welcome to Zen Center this morning, old friends and new. Hello, old friends. I'm Rosemary Taylor. I'm the associate guiding teacher, and I just want to introduce my friend Ben, who is speaking today.
Thanks, Rosemary. Good morning. It's good to see everybody. So today I'm going to talk about taking care of our place together. So in the Pali Canon, there's a story that says that at the moment of his enlightenment, the Buddha said, "House builder, you have now been seen. You shall not build the house again. Your rafters have been broken down. Your ridgepole is demolished too. My mind has now attained the unformed nirvana and reached the end of every kind of craving." Why didn't he just say, like, "This is great. I'm done suffering." He said, "House builder, you have now been seen. You shall not build this house again." So he's talking about the whatever it is in consciousness that makes the whatever this is that we could say we're experiencing right now, makes it into a self that sees things. So he's saying, I've seen the thing that makes unformed and unconstructed reality into a self that I think is an abode that continues and that I live in. And since I've seen it, it's done. And since that's done, I don't have to suffer, because I don't have to figure out what I like and what I don't like and run around after what I do like and run away from what I don't like. So this is just house builder. You have been seen. Now the thing is, if you then were to go meet the Buddha like the next day, you would not say there's no house there. You'd just see a person who appeared to be acting the way people do, speaking, and so forth. So outwardly, you can't see the destruction of this house. In fact, if you look at the history of what happened after he made this statement, for I think it's 45 years, but of course it's all made up, so I don't know. Well, not made up. It's probably inaccurately transmitted over the last 2,500 years. For a long time, what he did is he devoted himself to service. He wandered around the country, begging for his food, and helping people. So that house that was destroyed, that he saw disappear, that released him from suffering, didn't take away the fact that he decided to take care of his body. This house, he kept eating. He could have said, "House builder, you're destroyed. I don't need a body anymore." Right? But he did not. He took care of his body daily and carefully so that he could serve people, so that he could promote non-suffering. And that effort, or whatever it was, that non-effort, perhaps, is like living right here. What us being here, doing what we're doing, is just a manifestation of that lifetime. So, this is a talk about taking care of our place together. And it will sort of focus on taking care of, like, this place, as in this building, or whatever building it is that houses this community. And I'm sorry if you've never been here and you're like, I don't care about this building. I don't care about this community. I just thought Zen was kind of cool. Or my life sucks and I'm trying to find some way to be well. And you may think, I don't want to talk about the building. Well, that's cool. I get that. So I apologize for that. However, hopefully this talk isn't just about taking care of this building. It's about working together to take care of our place. Because we all have a place that we share. We have a planet we share. We have rooms we share with people. We have jobs we share with people. We have houses we share with people. So there is always the opportunity to be learning how to take care of our place together. Now, it's true, someone's saying, now, wait a minute. Buddha didn't have a house. Well, he grew up in a palace. But after, you know, when he set out on his path of liberation from suffering, he stopped living in a house. And he lived the homeless life. And he recommended the homeless life quite strongly to people as the way to be free from attachment. I'm guessing no one in here is opting for that path. Okay. Anyone? Okay. Me neither. I have a house. It's nice. But in the community that he practiced with, they traveled around. They lived sometimes separately, sometimes in groups outside. But people started building Buddhist monasteries. The Buddhist community started coming together to practice in buildings within a couple hundred years after his death, and they've been doing it ever since. Although there are still people who live and do homelessness practice. But here we have a place. This community of people has this building. And it didn't originally have this building. When MZMC started, some people convinced Katagiri Roshi to come from California to found Minnesota Zen Meditation Center. And I believe that they originally were practicing in someone's apartment in a fourplex in Dinkytown. And I don't know, so if you ever feel like this place is a little cramped and the bathrooms are weird, just think, hey, have you been in any apartments in Dinkytown recently? I don't know if there was an intervening place, but within a couple of years, they managed to acquire this building. And MZMC has been sited. The location for practice has been in this building now for just coming up. We're nearing our 40-year anniversary for people who like to celebrate. It started very small, and they got this place. And they did a practice here, and more people came. And people have been doing this here for the whole time. And a lot of kind of remarkable things have been done here. I mean, this was, as many of you know, the first Zen practice center that in the United States that wasn't in either California or New York. And it has, since its founding, about a dozen people who have trained here have found other Zen practice centers across the United States. And the legacy and reputation of this place is known all over the country. You know, if I go to California and go to a Zen center and talk to people, they go, oh, Minnesota Zen Meditation Center. Did you know Katagiri? I say, no. But I know the place. And I know the people. So the thing, though, is here is our building has problems. So I'll just keep this part of this talk minimal. But basically, our building has a bunch of stuff wrong with it that we've let go bad as a community, and I'll say more importantly as a board. And I'll say that because I'm on the board. I'm in my fourth year on the board. And we've let deferred maintenance happen. So this building needs a couple hundred thousand dollars worth of work on it. And since our annual budget is about $110,000 a year, that poses a problem. And I won't detail what the problems are, but they're substantial and they'll get worse if we don't take care of them. So why have we let this go bad? Because I don't like asking people for money. No one likes asking for people for money, and no one likes being asked for money. So we just haven't quite stepped up into this particular part of our situation. But anyway, we got to figure something out. So as a community led by the board right now, we're like, we're going to figure something out so we don't just let the building fall over, which is an exaggeration, but maybe not let the walls rot from the outside because water is penetrating them. How about that? So we're going to do something, and here's where it gets scary. The plan that is currently in place by the Minnesota Meditation Center Board of Directors is that within a month and a half, we will decide whether we're going to fix this building and stay here, we're going to fix this building and expand it, or we're going to sell this building and move to a new location. So, and we're going to offer you guys an opportunity to learn a lot more about that right after this talk. And also, we're going to have a big meeting in October so people can come together and we can talk as a whole community about the whole situation. And you might say, well, wait a minute, all we got to do is raise some money. But it's complicated because the thing is we can't fit all the people we have coming here into the building. So if we need more people to get more money, but we can't put more people in the building, you see there's moving parts. It's complicated. So anyway, it's a big choice. And if you don't know anything about it, you're like, ah, I don't want to hear about that. And if you do know, you may be like, I don't want to hear about that. And if you do know, you may have a really strong opinion about what we should do. That's quite possible. I can say from experience. So anyway, it's a big choice. Because there are people who have a really strong feelings or strong ideas about what we should be doing. About, wow, MZMC, this place has been here for 40 years. It's important. And so forth. So anyway, I don't know what we're going to do. I think we're going to figure it out, and that'll be good. And it's good to make choices. It's good to make choices together. So if you looked at your bulletin, you would have perhaps read this quote from the Book of Serenity, one of the great big collections of koans. The koan is called "The World Honored One Points to the Ground." When the World Honored One was walking with his assembly, he pointed to the ground with his hand and said, "This place is good for building a temple." Indra took a stalk of grass and stuck it in the ground and said, "The temple has been built." The World Honored One smiled. So the World Honored One here means Buddha, and Indra is like a Hindu god, I think. I should probably know that. So this story emerges at about 1,500 years after the death of Buddha, so it's not a historical record, I don't think. But what happens? Buddha says, this place is good for building a temple. Yeah, right by a lake. Indra took a small stalk of grass and stuck it in the ground and said, the temple has been built. The Buddha smiled. Well, that was easy. This is going to be easy, right? This is going to be easy. We'll all come to a meeting and everyone will just be like, I got a blade of grass, we got it done. This points, though, to freedom of mind. This was written in a time when most Zen practice and most Buddhist practice was done in temples, in big buildings. And they made really big, beautiful buildings in some of these places in China, because this is a Chinese work of literature I just read to you. Some of them were very simple, and some of them were very spare, but some of them were fancy, but they weren't blades of grass. Whoever wrote this wasn't saying, let's tear down all the temples. Let's have a blade of grass, everybody, when it rains. But it points to freedom of mind. It points to just saying, simple. Let's just have a simple idea and smile. She too takes this case up in the Song of the Grassroot Hermitage. He says, I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. The Chinese character that is translated here as hut actually means monastery, place of practice. I've built a grass monastery where there's nothing of value. So, what he's saying here is, I did the effort to build this thing. And what it is completely impermanent. It's made of grass. This is not going to last forever. Just like this building. Just like this community. Just like ourselves. I built it knowing that nothing lasts forever. I made the effort, fully acknowledging. Where there's nothing of value. Where I'm not attached to anything. That's what he's talking about. It's not like, oh, I built an awesome grass hut. Check it out. Check out the back room. It's really cool. Or like, I built a grass hut and it's kind of dumpy. But I'm hoping to get a shoe rack in there pretty soon. Later on, he says, bind grasses to build a hut and don't give up. He gives a series of practice instructions at the end of the Song of the Grassroot Hermitage. But one of them is bind grasses to build a hut. Make the effort to have a place of practice. Knowing you're just binding grasses. Because when you know you're just binding grasses, you have some openness. Sometimes I think, oh, you know, I have all these discussions on the board. I think, oh, if we do that with the building, MZMC may die. It's going to die. Everything dies. That's sad. But it's true. And maybe that's like too harsh. But for me, it's liberating. Oh, that's right. Once I say, oh no, what if it goes away? I can see what's happening is I'm just getting stuck. That's all that's happening. I'm stuck. Now I can take care of me in my stuck place and let go of processing this idea out here that I think is going to fix my feeling, making things the way I want them to be, which is hard to do when you're working with about 120 other people. Bind grasses to build a hut and don't give up. Don't give up. Sometimes we want to give up. You know, I don't want to go over there on Sunday. Every time I sit down, I just think for 40 minutes. Don't give up. I've been sitting this whole time, and it's like I still go back to my family and act like a jerk. Don't give up. Such a lovely story. Ananda was Buddha's attendant for pretty much his whole life of practice. And their relationship, if you read the really old Pali Canon Sutras, it's very intimate in a very beautiful way. That's different, you know, because the Buddha was not exactly like just doling out hugs all the time. He was very available, but in a very, very mellow way. So anyway, one day Ananda came in and he said, you know, Buddha, I sometimes think that good friends are a very important part of the way. And Buddha said, not so, Ananda. Good friends are the whole way. Good friends are the whole way. We need good friends to do this practice. Now, I will say, this also just points out why another great thing about the Buddha. When he's teaching, it's like Well, the next thing you know, he's going to say there are 8 things that are really important. And then there's another list of 16 things. When he teaches, he's not saying, I'm arriving at the absolute truth that we're going to hold on to forever. He sees Ananda. He sees the connection. And he says, good friends are the whole way, right now. In this moment. He responds to that moment with a complete teaching. But it's so true. There's no way I'd be doing this practice without you guys. And we need a place to do it in. Unless we're all just going to go meet up in a different park once a week. But, you know, I think it's going to be hard to do a session in December outside in Minnesota. There are people who live outside in Minnesota in December. That's too hard for me. So I found this fun quote here. So we don't, in the old school Buddha way, you know, they just go off in the woods, so they don't have to worry about having a house. Mm-hmm. They still had to deal with community, and there are stories in the thing about how great it is for them all to be together and how wonderful, and also how they had complex. Just people. But I found this thing by a guy named Yuan Wu, who was a Rinzai, a lineage holder, about 1000 AD. And he's talking about the kind of practice that actually we do, of which there's not that much record, which is a practice where we do Buddhist practice, but we just live lives where we have jobs, and we have families, and we own houses, and we have a lot of us, cars, bicycles, whatever. So, he says, when bodhisattvas who live a householder's life cultivate the practice of home leavers, it is like a lotus blooming in fire. It will always be hard to tame the will for fame and rank, power and position, not to mention all the myriad starting points of vexation and turmoil associated with the burning house of worldly existence. The only way is for you yourself to realize your fundamental, real, and wondrous wholeness and reach the stage of great calm, stability, and rest. Boy, that makes me a little hungry. I want to go there. I think I don't want the vexation and turmoil, and I do want the great calm, stability, and rest. That's all right. Some teachings make you hungry. You know, that hunger can encourage you to practice. And sometimes I'm like, come on, burning house of worldly existence? Come on, what kind? That's a pretty intense rhetoric. You know, it's been a while, but I, as just a person living in the world, have been like, yeah, this is like a burning house. I am really upset. It's intense. It's intense to be really upset. Vexation and turmoil. It's like a lotus blooming in fire. Wow. The only way is for you yourself to realize your fundamental and real wholeness and reach the stage of great calm, stability, and rest. The only way is not for you to figure out how to make the world be the way you want it, or how to make the things you're involved in go the way you want them to. The only way is for you yourself to realize your fundamental, real, and wondrous wholeness. How do we do that? In this Soto Zen tradition, we do that mostly by just attending to what is here. Attending to what is here. We practice attending to what is here by doing sitting meditation, because the mind is so incredibly averse to attending to what is here. And then we have the opportunity to attend to what is here throughout our day, to the people, to the mental constructions, to the emotions, all that. So, I have this big words on my paper that say dim vision, big vow. Dim vision, big vow. So here, I'm sort of talking about us as a community taking care of our place together. And dim vision is a term which was, I believe, coined by Kadagiri, but I could be wrong because people, you know, pick things up and repeat them and you never know. Dim vision. What he meant is, I don't know exactly what's going to happen. I'm just making this up. But I think it would be good if people in this part of the world did Zen practice, because Zen practice promotes peace and harmony. And, you know, the dim vision part wasn't like, what I want to do is in 20 years, I want to have MZMC with our Hokyoji monastery attached to it and a number of ancillary practice communities, and everyone will be doing the specific Japanese forms as duly noted and connected to the Soroshu Japanese institution of promoting... And it's like, I don't know. I'm just going to come in here and I'm going to teach the Dharma as best I can and do the practice and support people in doing it and see what happens. It's a dim vision. It's not, I'm going to have a bigger building. Not that I would be pointing at me. A bigger building so we can have lots more people. Or, we got to make sure we stay in this building because this building is where we have the mojo. It's a dim vision. And this dim vision is fostered by a big, big vow. The Japanese name for this place of practice is translated as living in vow. Living in vow. When I end this talk and we do our announcements, the last thing we'll do is we'll take the Bodhisattva vows together, for those of us who like to chant them, and we'll say, beings are numberless, bowing to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible, bowing to extinguish them. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it. Incomprehensible vows. They're numberless, they're beyond comprehension. They're boundless, beyond comprehension. The vow is big. We give ourselves to something really big. When we give ourselves to this vision of universal liberation, it opens up the consciousness to something bigger than, we need to do it this way, and then we'll get it right. I mean, think about the vision of Buddha 2,500 years ago. It didn't include what's happening here. Maybe it did. Maybe it's prophetic and he has superpowers. I have no idea. But I don't think so. Like, do you think he knew there were going to be like a big building like this in another part of the world? And people speaking this incomprehensible language. Doing this practice, it's really quite different than the one that was recommended by him. It has, we keep many things and we let go of some of them. But he had a vision. But what's come out of it is much bigger than what he could have imagined. What will come out of our community's practice and dedication to visioning the future of Minnesota Zen Meditation Center is going to be bigger and different than any of us envision. Both of these things, the Bodhisattva vow and this dim vision, lead us to to action that's not bound by attachment to fixed views. Because the vow is so big, it's like you get your fixed view and you go, but wait a minute, beings are numberless. It's too big to fit anything, for anything small to take it over. And the dim vision is all about just letting go of the narrowness of your view inherently. So they lead us to action without attachment, by not holding to fixed views. At the end of the Metta Sutra, the Loving Kindness Sutra, they go through lots of stuff that kind of makes our heart really big. If you want to get some good metta, you should come here on Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. and you'll get some guided loving kindness meditation to make your heart really big. It's probably already really big. Your heart's probably bigger than you could ever know. Maybe you'll just kind of see it a little bit. Wow, look at how big my heart is. Yeah, sometimes you also see, wow, my heart's kind of small when I think about that guy. Metta practice is good that way. At the end of the Metta Sutra, it says, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So, the bit not born again into this world is just like house builder you have been seen. It's like, we're done being stuck on our narrow vision, and we've opened up to the universe as it is. But what I think is distinctive is the method by which all these happen is by not holding to fixed views. This is the means by which the pure-hearted one is freed from all sense desires. So it's easy to get a fixed view. I've done it several times. Several million, maybe. I remember when we redesigned the Introduction to Zen Meditation class here a couple of years ago, and there were about four of us who were most intimately involved in that process, and lots of things we were changing, but the class used to be an hour and a half long, and I had been teaching it for years, and I was like, that's good. And for various reasons, it was like, well, logistically speaking, we have to make it an hour long. And I was like, that's terrible. That is a terrible idea. And I was like, we can't do that. And I was like, I remember, you know, I was like, why, God, how can we possibly? I thought, try to think of a million ways not to do that, to make it an hour long. And then I thought about how, even if we can't do it, we have to do it anyway. We have to not make it an hour long. I mean, I was just on this fixed view, and my mind was like, rah, 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 and I was thinking about it, and I was like, ooh, it's uptight. Well, we made it an hour long. God, I think it's pretty good. It turned out pretty good. I'm really happy. I still get to teach it. An hour seems like plenty of time. I've never had anyone say, could you make this a little longer? And no one falls asleep anymore, so that's got to be a benefit. So we practice letting go of fixed views. You know where this is going. We sit. It always keeps coming back to just sitting. When we sit, we can let go of our fixed views, because when views that come up are all fixed to some extent. Our minds are very inherently repetitive in the type of stuff they generate. And when they come up, sometimes we notice they come up and we let them go. We just practice not holding to fixed views. And if you do that, then you hold on less. And when you hold on less, you suffer less. Other people suffer less. Meditation builds a trust in things as they are. Or as Suzuki would say, things as it is. That is to say, the reason we have fixed views is because we're trying to figure it out so we can get the world to be okay. the human consciousness thinks, I got to figure everything out so I can manipulate the world effectively so I can be okay. That feels really good. But when we meditate and we just let go of these fixed views again and again, what arises out of it naturally is a trust. The feeling of trust. Or faith. Not faith in some kind of idea or ideology or viewpoint, but just emotional faith that things are okay. And this can help us trust our community. If we have the practice of learning to trust things, we trust things. You know, sometimes I don't trust the community. I think, no, we shouldn't do that. That's a terrible idea, having that class be an hour and a half long. Like, oh, what if I would have just remembered? Oh, that's right. When I sit down and work on things with these guys, it works out pretty well. It always works out pretty well. So trust takes practice for me. It takes practice. So it's about letting go of anxiety. And letting go of the way anxiety expresses itself, which is in people trying to control things. So I'm hoping that a lot of people who like to practice here will be interested in being involved in the process of moving our place forward and taking care of it. If you're not, that's okay. But I hope that as we do that together, we can have this kind of trust. We can remember our practice of letting go of fixed views. We can remember that it's difficult. Big decisions are difficult. We can remember the value of this place, whatever it is. It's been really good for me. You can know how good it's been for you. But a lot of people come through this place. 800 people a year come through this place who've never been here before, just to learn how to meditate. This community provides something really important and valuable to the world. At the end of the Fukan Zazengi, Dogen says, "You are taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way. You are taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way." And because at the end of this piece, which is the English translation of the name, is Universal Recommendation for Zazen, where he's talking about Zazen, it's easy to think, or the most obvious interpretation of this phrase is, when you meditate, when you do Zazen, you are taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way. Just a very encouraging statement. Come on. This is the only way that this tradition really manifests itself, is through Zazen. But that's a very narrow interpretation of the meaning of this phrase. He means, you are taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way. Your life is always the essential activity of the Buddha way. The world is always the essential activity of the Buddha way. All the Buddha way is everything doing itself. So you are taking care of it. How are you taking care of it? This is your opportunity. Right now. Whatever it is. And when we take care of this place, in a smaller sense again, we're taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way. Maintaining a place where people can do practice. Where people can give themselves to this tradition. Where they can get support. So, he says, you are taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way. But you is a nice flexible pronoun. because it is singular and it is plural. So he said to us, you, MZMC, you are taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way. Okay, well, I think that's what I want to say here. And I guess I would like to invent comments or questions.
Wonderful inherent paradox that seems to always show up in Buddhist teaching is interesting here in terms of everybody should invest in the idea of like being homeless, except that the only reason we can invest in being homeless is because there are people who have homes who then go home and cook and give us food. And, you know, it's that sort of like, it's really good to let go of that stuff, and yet it's really good to have a community. It's really good to be on your own, but it's really good to be part of a group that supports you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that inherent, you know, paradoxical sort of approach to things. But you kind of have to find the middle way.
Like when you talk about community, it's so important. Sangha, and that it's that piece of it outside of the house that matters. That is the house.
It's safe to be in this room right now, though, right?
The roof beams are destroyed.
All of this is like
the building itself?
About 100 years old.
I believe so.
110.
Yeah. 110 years old.
Appears to be kind of an open community because of, you can still see like the servants' stairs ways going up to the, you know, from the kitchen and stuff. Is it on the historic registry yet, or anything like that? Or is there any consideration?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Interesting to note that.
I was just wondering if that was something that had to be considered.
No, that's not one of the many issues. you know, I just like to note that we do have the servant stairs, and the main people who use that are the teachers.
It does occur to me that you talk about support structures, that the society as a whole, I kind of look more supportive of the practice in a way that's not true here. And in a sense, we have to be our own community outside as well as inside. So another reason, because, you know, I think about the little girl who went up and brought food to the Buddha, and he realized that starving himself wasn't going to work. And all the other cases where the community in the woods or on the hillside was supported by all of these people who said this is important.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have to do that for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. I mean, we're embedded in the middle of a society, and we draw things from that society, whether has a mind that is supporting us or not. So the connection's there. It's just maybe a little more deep, I think.
It's true we don't get lots of money from, like, the federal government. Like, I think some various nobles, like, gave land to the original Sangha for places that they could hang out when it was raining a lot. But, you know, the thing is, it's a totally different cultural relationship. And also, we are not making the kind of anything resembling the kind of total personal sacrifice that the renunciates in India were making. I mean, it might be that if you said, I'm going to renounce all my personal possessions that I cannot carry on my body for the rest of my life, you might be able to find people who'd support you in that. I don't know. But, you know, we're just doing a different thing. But in Zen, one of the innovations of Zen was the practice farm monastery. So the monastery was a farm. And they basically supported themselves within there, so they didn't have to be dependent as much on governmental largesse, which creates problems. So, I mean, there have been different ways to work this out all along. But it is true that right now, it's kind of like, at least financially, for the most part, we got to figure this out, my friend.
In the 70s, into the 80s, I think there was a woman who took the name of Peace Pilgrim, and her vow was to walk until mankind learned the ways of peace. And she walked for, I don't know how old she was at that point, she was white haired at that point, but walked the rest of her life, carrying only a toothbrush, and said that she did not eat until she was given food, and did not sleep until she was, or did not rest until she was given shelter, like offered it. She never asked for anything. She was just offered it to her.
That was in the good old U.S. of A.
Yeah.
And she's still got a great website, or someone maintains a website for it. It's really wonderful. Well, perhaps we should move on.